Hey, this is H1. We're going to be running it back with another episode talking about chess knowledge, chess wisdom, chess understanding. And today we got a guest here. He has got notes. All right. He has did a podcast, Perpetual Chess. He has launched it in 2016. Okay. And he has over a million downloads on all of his episodes combined, which is really awesome. It's a really big feat, and to actually stay consistent in that is really awesome. And he has interviewed authors, chess educators, NM Plus, Twitch streamers, and YouTubers. Just like I think he interviewed Vladimir Kremnik and Gotham Chess and Levy Rasman and Ben Feingold. Yeah. And
that's
so
right. Go on.
Yeah. There you go. Just trying to give you the perfect introduction like you always do in your videos. Okay. And it's probably weird for you to be the guest too. So
yeah, I've done it a few times. Thank you. Thank you for the introduction. Yeah, my name is Ben Johnson, and yeah, happy to talk chess with another chess podcaster, Devon, which secretly, listeners, I'm gonna tell you guys that H1 also goes by Devon, so I'm going to keep him off balance here. But anyway, happy to be on the show.
Yeah, I'm glad that you could be on the show. And you know what? This is going to be really fun, really cool, just to get your perspective on chess and how you even started doing the podcast. And we're like, you even learned how to play chess too, so that's going to be pretty interesting. Going to be cool to interview Ben Johnson. Just for all of my audience to know, his name is Ben Johnson, who's over Perpetual Chess. So actually, let's just go through the first question. You know, how did you even like start playing chess, get into chess? What age did you start playing chess, and what experiences do you have, pretty much?
Okay, so first thing listeners should know is I'm an old man. I'm 44 years of age, two kids. So I've been playing chess for a long time. I learned when I was six. I grew up in Center City, Philadelphia. And my school, Masterman School, had what was just starting as a chess program then, but it became kind of a powerhouse. They won the National Scholastics a couple times. Program was getting started when I was there. So it just kind of piqued my interest. When I had learned how the pieces move when I was six, and I loved chess right away, but I didn't know about the chess world until I was 12 when it was at my school. And that school, I was very lucky because we had other strong players, including Greg and Jennifer Shahadi, who are been friends of mine for, man, I'm old, like 30 years now. I saw them today. So that's how it all started. And just, you know, like a lot of people, I've loved chess ever since, but had periods of activity and inactivity in my adulthood.
Oh, okay. What was the other activities that you did instead of chess?
Yeah, so I went to college, graduated with a major in politics and Russian, and I thought maybe I was going to go to law school. So I worked at a law firm for a couple years. I'm trying to give the very short version so as not to put people to sleep.
Feel comfortable to talk, and yeah, no problem. Okay. This is you. This is all you.
All right. I'm going to do every detail. Here we go.
Yeah.
So I worked at a law firm for a couple years and then ended up teaching at this nonprofit called Chess in the Schools, in theory, while I was going to be applying to law school. But I ended up really enjoying teaching chess. And of course, I got to know some pretty accomplished people in the chess world in New York. I mean, I was roommates with Mike Klein, Fun Master Mike, for a while, and Elizabeth Spiegel, and a bunch of great folks from Chess in the School that showed me the ropes. And so I did that for a few years, and that kind of showed me that I didn't really want a corporate type job. But then I ended up playing poker. That was kind of during the poker boom days that, listeners might remember, especially in the 2000s, there was tons of poker on TV. And if you had like a studious approach to games, as a lot of chess players do, you could make money without being a super genius. So me and a bunch of my chess player friends all did pretty well, I should say. And I played poker professionally for 7 years, had some success, got to travel a bunch, played both online and at tournaments. And then I tried out trading stocks for a few years. That didn't go as well. So eventually as I was done with poker and then looking for something else, I kind of actually always knew that, like, I was happy when I was teaching chess and that I could go back to chess. So I went back to chess and started running Scholastic programs. And it was around that time that I started the podcast, which was about 5 years ago.
Man, that's really awesome. It seems like every chess player knows how to play poker.
Yeah, especially for my generation. But even now, I mean, and it's a mixed bag. I mean, poker, it can be a blessing and a curse. It can enable one to carve their own path, but it's also, you see, it's not for everyone, and some people it has a negative effect on their lives. So, just gotta treat it like a business, like everything else, you know.
Yeah, that's crazy, huh? Because I know, so Greg Shahadi is probably is related to Jennifer Shahadi, right? So,
yep, her older brother.
Yeah, and I know
he's
Jennifer
an international Shahadi. Master.
Right.
Super, super great blitz player, and good guy.
Right, and I know Jennifer Shahadi is a poker player, like a professional.
Yeah, so. Well, so was Greg. Greg and I were both professionals for a long time, and we were trying to convince Jen to get into it for years. It took her a while. I mean, she was like a few years younger, first of all, two-time U.S. women's champion, so she had a lot going on, so it took her a while to warm up to it, but now she's like the most prominent by far of the three of us, both in the chess world and in the poker world.
Man, so yeah, that's crazy. Yeah, I never really got into poker, but yeah, that seems pretty interesting to like move from chess to poker, then back to chess. And so you started after you went into college and law school, then you started Scholastic programs around the world.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I lived not in Pittsburgh world, at the time. Yeah. So yeah, started locally there. And these days I live in central New Jersey, like kind of smack in the middle between New York and Philadelphia.
Yeah, that's a good spot too, you know? So yeah, that's awesome. Man. And so did you get taught by Greg Shahadi?
I didn't, but I have to give a shout out to his dad, Mike Shahadi, who's also a FIDE master. I've been rated over 2300 USCF. So when I was a kid, we were really good friends. So I spent a lot of time at the Shahadi's family house, and Mike definitely would go over games with me. And I said, you know, hook me up where I sat in on a few lessons he was doing with Greg and stuff like that. And also what Greg gave me and the Shahadis and other folks in that area was just sort of a chess culture. So, so Greg, I mean, now, you know, at some point, you know, since I'm a year older, there was a brief period even where I was stronger than Greg. And, you know, I did make it to USCF Master, but it didn't last long where I was stronger than Greg. So nowadays, like if I have a chess question, he's one of the friends that I can ask, but he was never like formally my teacher.
Oh, snap. I never really asked you, what's your rating?
So my rating peaked at around like 2270 many, many years ago. It's been moving in the wrong direction for a long time now, Devon, and it's about 2100 now. And it's interesting. I don't feel that much worse than I was then. But I think the competition has gotten tougher. And as you get older and have kids, it's even if you feel like you know a lot about chess, it's hard to just play good moves. You know, you make more mistakes. So that's something that comes up a lot on the podcast. And I'm still trying to turn the mothership around. But it takes a lot of work.
It seems like the older I get, I try to do like easier openings, like the London system or like something that I can just do very quickly. And then most of the chess nowadays is usually like fast form chess, like 5 minutes, 10 minutes and things of that nature. So yeah, I definitely understand that. Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah, man. Although you're a young man, I will say you have kids though, right? But how old are you, Devon?
Yeah, I'm 23. So
yeah, you're super young, but you have kids, which changes everything. But that changes everything. That changes your priorities. And it's tough to grind like hours of openings a day.
Right. I think I tried it one time. I was trying to learn some openings. I think I was trying to learn the Tirage right now, the Tirage defense. And yeah, my daughter, everything just becomes, you can't be selfish anymore and just put all your time towards yourself. You have to like put it towards the kid first. Everything is around the kid. So
that's admirable though. You're doing the right thing, man. So, so good for you. You know, chess is, it's a great hobby. Great if you can, you know, turn it into a profession, but you know, family first.
Yeah, yeah. because you don't want to miss those precious moments.
Even though
the kid does something that's, yeah, just kids just do stupid things for some reason. I remember one time my daughter, I was just laying on the couch just watching TV, and then like she just put her shirt over her face. She was like 15 months. She just put her shirt over her face, and then she just ran straight towards the TV stand. And wow. There's nothing you can stop. You cannot stop that. You can't even prepare for something like that at all. And yeah, it's just a full responsibility. Pretty much. And so have you, since your kids are 5 and 8, I'm guessing that you taught them how to play chess by now. And
so my 8-year-old, I taught him how to play chess. I ran a program at his school. It just hasn't taken. He's kind of a competitive kid. And I would never let him win. And it seems to have had a negative effect on his interest in chess. So, 'cause he likes brain games, but he doesn't like to play chess. And the 5-year-old, I haven't taught her check and checkmate and stuff like that. Excuse me, but we play mini games. So you can, you know, there's like the pawn race where you have just 8 pawns against 8 pawns and whoever gets one to the other side first. But there's also games you can play that are even simpler than that. So with my daughter, we play one called Collect the Coins, where like each side gets 2 rooks. You put the rooks like on adjacent files instead of the same file so that they can't just take each other on the first move. And then you put a bunch of coins in the middle of the board, and it's a race. You take turns moving your rook like a rook to see who can capture the most coins. So it's like a way to make the game to still learn taking turns and learn the way one piece moves. And then whoever gets the most coins wins. And she loves that game, but you know, I kind of leave it up to her, like when to introduce more pieces. And we don't play super often, but when we do, she's happy just playing Collect the Coins.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome, because you know, I think most grandmasters they usually start off with something small, something simple, then it builds up from there. So yeah, it's usually the kid's decision after that. Yeah, that's what I think. But you know,
yeah, I think it should be. Yeah, yeah. I'm not gonna push them. We'll see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you definitely have way more parenting experience than me. You know, I'm a newcomer.
Yeah, well, we're all on the same footing. Parenting is the great equalizer. You know, if you're Bill Gates or you work at McDonald's, like you're going to be changing that crappy diaper sometime. So
yeah,
we're all in the same boat.
It definitely humbles you pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah, shoot. Okay, well, let's go on to, so when you got into podcasting, I can see that you was like really interested in the chess world when you was training with basically the Shahadi family, and so that pretty much probably inspired you to like want to do podcasts and interview a lot of authors and YouTubers and things of that nature and chess educators, and to get in this world on chess a lot more, I'm guessing.
Yeah, that was a big part of it. I'm like, I love podcasts every bit as much as I love chess, and my interests are all over the place. So when I started Perpetual Chess in 2016, there was one chess podcast that kind of came and went. Shout out to Full English Breakfast, which was kind of like a chess news show that Ginger GM, Simon Williams, Lawrence Trent, who of course has announced some world championships, always an entertaining guy, and Macaulay Peterson, who's, you know, nowadays he's a lawyer, but he's great technical skills and was the one who produced the show. They had a podcast and that was it. And I was driving all around Pittsburgh to go to different schools and pick up my kids and all that stuff. And I just noticed that there were no chess podcasts. And, you know, I'm not a grandmaster. I felt like me, you know, a grandmaster or someone like that should be doing this. But in the meantime, like, no one was. And I, in addition to Greg and Jen, I have some other reasonably well-known friends in the chess world. Like, I met Jan Gustafsson of Chess 24 many, many years ago. So we're old friends. And I felt like I knew enough people where I could probably, like, line up a handful of interviews and see what happened. And that's kind of what I did. And I told myself I'd do it for 6 months and see how it was going. And, you know, it was going well enough after 6 months that I've been doing it ever since.
Yeah, that's awesome. Because on that point, like, yeah, I guess a grandmaster should be doing it. But at the same time, Most of the best teachers aren't grandmasters, so
yeah,
you know, it's kind of
I don't know, that might have been like a story I was telling myself, because you know how it is when you're like trying to find the energy to do something and there's also a voice in your head that's rationalizing not doing something,
right.
So that was the voice in my head. But you know, if you look at the success of someone like Agat Mater, which obviously has happened subsequently to that, he's proven that, you know, there's more to making popular chess content than just how good you are at chess.
This is the waiting room segment, Chess Jokes by H1. And the joke of today is, what is the easiest way to move your castle? Remote control. You get it? Remote control. And I know this is kind of reaching for a chess joke. I know it is. But still, it's a joke. Man, you do this job. You do this job every single week and come up with jokes for the waiting room segment. Man, send me some jokes in my DMs on H1 Chess on Instagram. Send me the jokes. Send me. Thank you for listening. Right. I have a theory that I think it's mostly like a mindset thing. What do you think about that? Like, because I know when I was growing up playing chess, like I had to get rid of that fear. Like when I was facing high schoolers in middle school, I had to get rid of that fear that like that they're better than me, and like because when you have that mindset that you can pretty much beat anybody. You can't really, in order for you to be at the top, you can't really fear the top, pretty much.
Yeah.
Like, that's why I have that mindset. Even if I'm playing Magnus Carlsen, I'm going to come after them, because usually chess players don't like defending anyway. So, so that's why I think, like, podcasts like these are really important, so that people can get that mindset maybe over the road or while they're doing dishes, so that when they get into, like, their real chess games, and they can be like, ah, okay, I already know what to do. Let me be more aggressive and beat this guy or something like that.
I mean, it helps to have no fear for sure.
Yeah. So, man, so that's crazy. So you started at six. So it took off pretty much after that 6 months, after you did the interviews and things of that nature, and you started contacting more people.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it took off. Honestly, it's been a very slow and steady climb. I mean, to the extent that anyone could say it took off, it's been within like the last, you know, the Queen's Gambit, the last year and a half. But really, it was like, if you graphed sort of the popularity of the podcast, it's been very slow and steady. I mean, the good thing about the early days is like it found a foothold, you know, so that I felt like, all right, at least some people are listening. I have a base I can build from, and that's kind of what has happened. And I've been, you know, it's my, even before I was making like any money on it, it was my favorite professional thing, because my other work was fine, but it wasn't as fun to me as like talking to these grandmasters and educators and authors and all that stuff.
Right. And yeah, that's really awesome that you actually got to, most people aren't in their passion that they want to do, so that's really awesome that you actually found that and continued it too, and now you got like networking connections, and now you get to basically live this life just talking about chess. I feel like that's really awesome.
Knock on wood. hopefully it can continue. But I definitely consider myself lucky, so I try not to take it for granted.
That's cool. So okay, you interviewed a lot of people, right? So what would you say would be the best advice, the like top three best advice to give somebody that's starting out playing chess?
Out of all the people, see,
that you pretty much, like, I know that you got a lot of knowledge in here, right? Now you have to cipher through all
that. Are we talking like top three chess improvement tips?
Yeah.
Or, okay. I mean, number one, you know, I'm not going to, no prizes for originality here, but you really do need to do some tactics. You really need, especially if you're on the newer side to chess, you just got to build that tactical base, learn to visualize the board. And number two, if you really are, like, I know a lot of adults have gotten into chess, or like they learned how to play when they were a kid, but they never played a tournament. If you are the type of person who kind of struggles with the board coordinates, which I know a lot of adults who didn't play chess as kids do, it really can have sort of, in my opinion, a compounding effect to invest a lot of time early. Like on, like, you know, chess.com has like the visualization trainer where you just, the name of the square pops up and you have to click it, you know. Mm-hmm. And then beyond that, you can do like simple visualization drills. Like Chessable has this course called Visualize where they say, okay, you know, white plays knight to f3, black plays pawn. Say you're speaking from the starting position, white plays knight to f3, black plays pawn to e5. Why is that a mistake? You know, so obviously, very simple question for an experienced player. You just take the pawn. But when you're building from the ground up, I really think it's good to sort of lay the groundwork as much as you can. And number three, I really think if people are able to, it is beneficial to invest in a coach. These days, you know, if you go to like the Lee Chess coaches page or the chess.com coaches page, there's a million coaches, and there are lots of them overseas that have very reasonable rates. So I can get, especially with so much free information on the internet, I understand why people feel like they don't need them or feel like they shouldn't get them. But, you know, if you can afford, you know, $15 a week to get an overseas coach who's like, you know, rated over FIDE 2000, I really think it's a great accelerant in terms of like them providing direction to you. So I could go on for a long time, but that's three tips for everyone.
Yeah. So yeah, having a coach is definitely an accelerant. You can learn everything online. It's just going to take a lot more time since a coach, you know, targets actually your mistake. And like now you got to fix that right now.
Yeah.
So yeah. And a coach can really look at that from an outside perspective. So yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they just save you so much time that it's worth it in the long run.
Yeah. Do you feel like for you to, I guess that's a silly question, but do you feel like for you to be really a really strong player, you pretty much have to have a coach nowadays?
I mean, there's tons of the grandmasters. I mean, I don't know about tons, probably the minority, but there are self-taught grandmasters out there. It's not like you can't do it, but I think especially if you're already an adult, I think that's where like you really have to value your time. And that's why I think it can be worthwhile. But, you know, I understand that it costs money. So there's workarounds like with everything else. You know, there's chess discords. You know, you can catch a Twitch streamer who doesn't have a lot of people watching and just start peppering them with questions. You know, so there is stuff you can do. But certainly, I mean, so much of chess, historically, so much of chess improvement came from sort of your network and sort of absorbing the culture. And now with the internet, there's the feeling that you can sort of be enveloped, but there's still no substitute for like just talking about chess with someone, especially if they're a little bit stronger than you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And so, okay, so you mentioned the Queen's Gambit, like that pretty much boomed the podcast. Because it did basically the same here, right? Because you get a lot more viewership, a lot more people that's trying to learn how to play chess afterwards. So have you actually how did that audience like treat you, and like have you ever got a chance to like talk to some of them and see like because I got to talk to some of my viewers on like a Facebook group, like, oh snap, they watched the Queen's Gambit and they watched it with their family, and then they realized, oh snap, maybe I should play chess, and now a father and their daughter, now they play chess together, which is super cool. Do you think about that gain of audience nowadays?
Yeah, it's interesting because my podcast, like I try to remember if there's some like, you know, random chess term that comes up, I try to work it into the interview to sort of explain what it means. But I can't lie, like I don't envision Perpetual Chess as like a straight up entry level podcast. I mean, you know, I'm often interviewing people who spent their lives immersed in the game. So it took me a while, like the numbers were definitely up, but it took me a while to sort of meet the community of new listeners. I was doing some group classes. I think I heard you mention you're thinking about doing group classes. I was doing that for a while, and that really helped helped me understand sort of the perspective of someone who's, you know, smart person, captivated by chess, but not a lot of experience. And it's I love interfacing with people like that. I mean, I love talking chess with them, but it definitely like it took a while to filter sort of from like, hey, more people are listening to like who the people are and sort of how to manage the programming, as it were, like try to make it a bit more accessible at times.
Yeah, I can see that because your podcast is like, usually you have Grandmaster, International Master, somebody with a title on there, and usually, yeah, you don't go from the beginning. It's not like an entry level. Yeah, so I see how. Yeah, so that's really good that you actually try to put some stuff in for entry people so that they can basically understand.
Yeah, your podcast. And if you don't mind, Devon, I got to give this stuff a plug. So for anyone listening,
go right ahead. Yeah, do what you got to do.
I do a series called Adult Improvers, where like instead of interviewing grandmasters, I interview adult chess players who've had some sort of rating gain, and they sort of share some tips, recommend some resources, stuff like that. So I found that a lot of adult chess enthusiasts who maybe are not like super immersed in the culture of chess, but want to improve their games. Those are the episodes they gravitate towards. And then I also do ones that are like book recaps, and people really enjoy those. So those compared to like, even if I'm interviewing some legend, you know, like often people newer to chess, like, you know, Vishyananda's a genius, obviously, and it was amazing to get to interview him. But like, if you're kind of new to the chess world, you might not be able, you know, you might not have as much experience where like your level of chess is able to keep up with all the stories he tells and stuff like that.
Right. And okay, so you mentioned the book recaps. So I know this is like a new era of chess. What do you think is better to study chess? Like reading a really good chess book or watching like a set of good, a good series of videos?
Yeah, I think it's different for different people. So I need to be actively learning. What I found personally with videos is I start to daydream, and suddenly it's like 5 minutes later and I don't even know like what has been on the past 5 minutes. And with the nature of videos, it's a little hard to go back to the exact spot where you were. And plus, I grew up with chess books, so they always will have a special place in my heart. And then, of course, there's learning tools like Chessable. I have a great relationship with them. They're longtime sponsors of Perpetual Chess. Prem Podcast might not have made it without their support. And I think their spaced repetition is amazing, especially like so for, say, 1500-1600 on up, like to learn openings that way is just like a total game changer. And if you're below that level, I think their tactics courses are like an amazing resource because first of all, it's very user-friendly presentation. And second of all, like the fact that you're able to repeat the patterns, which I know not everyone thinks is like a great, I would say the jury's still out on like repeating tactical patterns as opposed to trying to learn new ones. But in my opinion, for adults who like whose memories aren't as sharp as kids, I think it's a great way to go.
When I started out playing chess, I had this old chess book. It was called Chess Wisdom by Eric. I forgot his last name, but it was
Schiller.
That's what I pretty much studied to like get past the thousand rating, pretty much, just to get the simple basic openings. And it pretty much had everything in one book. And so, and YouTube wasn't that big just like a decade ago. There's not that many there was probably some people that was coaching on YouTube, but it wasn't really exciting. And plus I kind of had that same experience where I would just go to sleep, and I was a kid and I was hyperactive, and I was like, this isn't working. I'll just read this book or play on my PlayStation 2 and I had so I had Chessmaster on PlayStation 2, so that was pretty entertaining too.
Nice.
So I talked about that in my first episode, how I learned how to play chess. But yeah, that's pretty interesting. One other thing I wanted to talk about. So you're 2100 right now. Did you ever go through like a stage where you was at one rating for like a long time and you didn't know why you wasn't improving? Because that stage of mine was like 1600, right? Where I was like, why can I pass 1600? Why is it such a hard rating to pass? Everybody above 1600 just seems way harder than below it. Have you ever had like that type of rating?
Honestly, more than anything, I'm there now. Now it's been a bumpy road with many breaks in between and children and career changes and all that stuff. So that sort of, it's not like I've been grinding every day, batting my head against the wall. It's been periods of trying to improve and it doesn't happen. And then I just give up for a while, that sort of thing. So this, I mean, honestly, you know, as I mentioned, my rating high is 2270 and my current rating is like 2100. So I don't even expect to reach new highs. I just want to sort of get back to 2200 as like a long-term goal. But before that, I think my biggest plateau was 1900. But I've noticed with a lot of the grandmasters that I interview, you know, they try to be relatable. But a lot of them, it was kind of a glide path. You know, there was just something in their brain where they just kind of slow and steadily ascended. And obviously, I'm not a grandmaster, but you know, I went from new to chess to USCF master in about 5 years. You know, 1900, I might've been stuck for a bit, but I was playing so much and I wasn't fixated on the results. So it doesn't compare to like what I hear from a lot of people encountering now. And honestly, what I myself encounter at this kind of permanent plateau.
So that's interesting. You're still active in chess tournaments, right? What chess
here and there, I tried to play again last month for the first time. I mean, obviously the pandemic was an issue, so I didn't play for 2 years, and then I played once. But now, I got worried about the Delta variant, so now I don't know how much I'm going to play again in the near future. But certainly, I've had periods of activity. You know, like 5 years ago in Pittsburgh, I played for like a year and a half, and it's not like I was just suddenly getting better. Like that wasn't. What I was doing wasn't enough, clearly.
Right. And that just pretty much ruined everything because there wasn't any over the board chess tournaments to play yet. And then online isn't the same as playing over the board. It just isn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I always tell people new to chess, like try one chess tournament. You know, you might decide it's not for you. That's totally reasonable, but at least try it because you'll understand it a lot better then. It's hard to explain how much more meaningful it feels.
Yeah. Like, for example, if I'm winning a chess game, I like to see the demise right. of my opponent while I'm beating
exactly.
him.
Exactly. You know? Yeah, I like it. Yeah. Yeah.
So, and I don't get that satisfaction over the board after I beat somebody, then we just go to the next game, and then I was like, okay.
I'm sorry, Devon. I have to tell a story. I don't play a ton of online Blitz. But last, I guess it was 2 nights ago, I had this experience where it's like, and you know, you're like alone, my wife's asleep, you're like alone in your house and there's someone you want to tell. And so it's going to have to be you, I apologize.
Okay, it's fine.
I was playing this Blitz game on Lee Chess and we get to a position where it's like rook and three pawns against rook and three pawns on the same side of the board. And it's 3-0, the time control, so no increment. And I have like 20 seconds and he has like 40. And it becomes clear within like a handful of moves, this guy has decided he's going to dirty flag me. So for listeners who don't know what that means, it's like, sometimes you, there's a gray area in what's allowed and what's not allowed, or what's like, what's good etiquette and what's not good etiquette in a speed chess game. But basically, if a game is a dead draw and you have a little bit more time, it's not considered good etiquette to just move until they have 0 seconds. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, to me, Devon, like when you have 20 seconds and they have 40 and it's rook and three on the same side, I felt that this was in the dirty flag category. Before I finish the story, what do you think?
So I call it, I just call it a part of the game now, because I don't like to make, because you can't make it the excuse like, you know, they dirty flagged me. But at the same time, I wasn't like I didn't manage my time correctly. So right. I call it just finessing the opponent.
Yeah, I mean, you know, yeah. I get what you're saying, and like, what are you gonna do? I wasn't gonna curse him out in chat or anything like that.
Right, you can't do that online. You can't.
Yeah. So, you know, it is what it is. But I wasn't really happy about it. I certainly would give a draw in that situation, and like most people I know would. But anyway, this story has a happy ending because when there are about 13 seconds on the clock, I see he's moving instantly, and I see his only goal is to flag me. So I put my rook somewhere where he can take it. You know. But if he moves this rook, like, in the same pattern he has been doing, just up and down one square, I'm going to take his rook. So right. I made sure to do that when I had enough time to still win the game if he instantly made his move and then I took the rook. So that's what I did. I put my rook in take on purpose where I could then take his, got his rook, won the game. And I was so proud and really wanted to talk trash to the guy. But again, there's no one there. No one cares, you know.
Yeah.
Gotta love the beauty of the psychological battle.
Yeah, that's good. That's perfect. I, you know, not to be like that mean guy, but I support that 100%, you know. Yeah. It's part of chess nowadays. You really, it seems like every time I play online, it's, every opponent does it. It's just part of the game now.
And maybe next time he'll give a draw now.
Yeah, exactly. And that too, like, he was doing the dirty flagging first. So, hey, let's get started. But that's awesome. This is the Waiting Room segment. Chess quotes by H1. And the quote of today is, man, the Chess Perpetual podcast, it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. Thank you for listening. So you play on Lead Chess. What's your, do you play Blitz a lot on there?
Yeah, I go through periods of activity and inactivity, but I, you know, not a week doesn't go by where I don't play, put it like that. But, you know, some weeks I'm playing, you know, again, working parents. So I, you know, some of the my chess online friends, you know, God bless them, they're in their 20s. They don't have a wife and kids. And I see them just spending hours a day on chess. And for me, it's not like that. But so on a day where I do a lot, I'll play 45 minutes of Blitz. And then days go by where I don't play. But I would say I probably average like a game or two a day, something like that. So,
hey, that's really good. You know, the most irritating thing, another irritating thing about online chess is that if you don't have good internet, it just makes everything just a lot worse. For example, like I could be in a I've had games like this. I'm completely winning, just two queens up, and then like the last move of checkmate, you know, and the internet just decide to mess up. I have to refresh the whole thing, and then the game, it doesn't want to get back into the game because 30 seconds later it makes the opponent claim the win even though they're losing, and I don't even know why they played on because I had two queens.
Right.
it's crazy. Yeah, it's a whole nother world. Especially, it's kind of weird seeing the top rated, like Magnus Carlsen, Fabiano Caruana, play online chess too, because it seems like that they have an opportunity to play in their own countries in the World Chess Tour. So that's pretty interesting. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I love that. That really shows that Magnus has the love, because he'll have these all-night bullet sessions, you know, just like out of the blue, like just six-hour session against Nereditsky or Penguin GM or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, Fabiano seems to keep a lower profile, and of course, he's not known as like a blitz and bullet specialist the way that Magnus is. But I love it. I mean, I love to see the guys who are in it for the love of the game, you know. Obviously, they've had great success too, but like people who just can't get enough, and you know, for no prize money, will still have these epic sessions.
Yeah, I usually like seeing Hikaru Nakamura play his games, even though, you can never get used to that.
He is a wizard, man. He is amazing. I mean, what can you say?
Yeah, I don't know how he does it. I know he's spent a lot of years doing it. but still, it just amazes me.
And it's also like he's not slowing down, you know? He's not as young as he used to be, and he's just as amazing at blitz and bullet.
Right. What do they say? The age, there's like an age limit where it's statistically you're supposed to dip down in the rating, I think, after 30 years old or something.
Early
30s. But I think he's number one in blitz now worldwide. Yeah. So yeah, this is crazy. He's a streamer, YouTuber. Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. I like the hustle.
Yeah. He's crushing it. Yeah.
Yeah, for real. Okay. Well, I got a fun segment for us to do.
Okay.
We got a would you rather questions so that everybody can get your personality, you know, get a little bit more about you. So I found these online in different forums. And I thought they was hilarious. So
okay, here we go.
Here we go. Number one, would you rather lose 3 games in a row or stalemate in a winning position?
Are we talking classical chess or blitz? I know they don't specify, but
Well, let's just do all 3 of them. Let's just do both of them.
Okay. I mean, for classical chess, you've got to fixate on it so long that I would rather just have one screw up. I would rather just stalemate a winning position, because if I lose 3 in a row, then it's like the kind of agony compounds, you know. For blitz, it's probably the same, but I don't stress too much about blitz, honestly. So I wouldn't really care either way with blitz, unless they were trying to dirty flag me.
Yeah, my experience, my worst losses was losing a winning game. I mean, stalemate in a winning game. I would just take the 3 losses. I don't care.
Okay.
Yeah, I would just take the 3 losses, because I would psychologically just be ruined after that and just be like, wow. Let's say I was facing somebody big, like, let me see, Susan Polgar, and I'm like, wow, I was winning and I stalemated.
Right.
This is super embarrassing to me, and I can never live that down. So I would just, I would take the 3 losses, no doubt.
Okay.
The next one, would you rather, they said, would you rather play a chess game without all your pawns or without your queen?
Pawns are the soul of chess, man. Gotta have the pawns.
Yeah.
You can always get a queen. So I gotta have my pawns.
That makes a lot of sense. But you only get that one true queen, though. You know?
Well, you know, they all look the same.
Wow.
I mean, yeah.
You have a family, right? Now I'm just playing. Never mind. Yeah, okay. I get that. Yeah, the pawns, you can just get different queens based on the game, not real life. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
That's separate. Yeah. Okay. Next one. Would you rather play d4 your whole life or e4 your whole life?
I've been an e4 player, but now that I'm an old man, I'm in the process of switching. But I have to keep it real, you know, like E4 is closer to my heart.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm already a D4 player. I love playing a Catalan. So, I would just have to go
with
D4.
Oh, man, the Catalan's a nice opening. Yeah, it's good.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like a favorite song from when you're a kid or something. You got to go with the one that, like, that you remember from your formative years.
That is true. I think every kid, like, whoever started playing chess, they always played E4. I think in every tournament, every kid, E4. In the Guccio piano.
Except now when you got coaches teaching kids the London. But back in our day, that didn't happen.
It didn't. Not at all. Yeah, exactly. It was, and then you can actually do the Roy Lopez and things of that nature.
Yeah.
And yeah. These kids nowadays is playing Sicilians against me. I'm like, why are you playing a dragon at me? You're only like 6 years old. Okay.
Right.
One more. So would you rather get checkmated or resign?
You know, have you heard this thing where people say it's like classy to allow your opponent to checkmate you, like you know, in certain positions, and especially now with newer chess fans who sometimes when a like grandmaster game, sometimes when there's a resignation, people are like, what? Like, I don't even see what's going on in this position.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, there's something classy about getting checkmated. I'd say it's okay to get checkmated.
Hmm. I don't know. Yeah, I would disagree with you on that one. Maybe, but I play more online, where I think online I'm like, you know what? They're one move away from checkmate. I'm not going to let them get that satisfaction. And I'm not going to lie. I just resign. Yeah. And yeah, just go on with the next game. Maybe. And then plus, let me see. In a real tournament, I was taught when I was playing chess at a really young age to play throughout the game and just get checkmate in and whatever. But as I got older, yeah, I don't like to be psychologically broke down, especially in a classical game, which I already know that they're winning, and I'm not going to play another hour just to defend this losing position.
I should clarify. I was thinking more of like if they have some nice combination, you know, like if they play a mating sequence where like they're checkmating you or four and four or whatever, and at some point you see it's coming, then it can be nice to let them play the checkmate. But yeah, I'm not one of these guys that's like, shout out to Jonathan Korvla, an old friend of mine, who like famously talks about how he never ever resigns and like, you know, tortures his opponents by like making them play these positions where they're up like a rook and a knight and, you know, how many stalemates he's gotten from doing that. That's not me. So yeah, I should clarify that.
But you don't want to be like, okay, let's say that they did have a combination, right? And let's just say that you dislike the chess player, you know, just a little bit. Let's say, and they had like a three move combination. You're not going to just do like two of the moves and then just resign last move.
If I dislike them, sure, but that's gonna be the minority. See, I think what it is, Devon, is you're young and you still got like the fire in your belly. I'm an old man. Like you know, I think part of the reason I'm not as strong as I used to be is like it doesn't quite mean as much to me, and I think that hurts my game, honestly. And it's hard to get that back, you know. So I think that's part of why you're like I want to see them suffer, you know. And I'm like, well, I used to want to see them suffer. now I don't really care,
you know. I was only like this because I, you know, my brother, he was very harsh on me. He was the one that throughout my whole first year I was playing him, and I'll lose every single game to him. And so, and every time like he would snatch pieces, he was one of those players where every time he snatched my queen, it was like a really loud clink sound. Yeah, it was very embarrassing. So yeah, and then I played in libraries with like trash talkers and things of that nature. So yeah, that's where the spirit comes from.
I understand.
So I'm not just devious in real life, you know, just to make that clear. I'm just very competitive. Right. Very competitive.
Understandable.
Yeah. But other than that, how much effort would it be to get Magnus Carlsen on your podcast one of these days?
Yeah, I get asked that a lot. You know, I mean, he owns Chessable, Aim Chess too. Shout out to Aim Chess. It's awesome that they're sponsoring you, man. They're a great company, and they do great work. I love their algorithms. I love to go through them after my blitz sessions. But you know, I think it will happen someday, dare I say. I mean, unless he like stops doing interviews, you know, I've interviewed his head trainer, Peter Hein Nielsen. I've interviewed Jan Gustafsson. He's a friend of mine, and he's, you know, been on Carlsen's team. You know, some of his companies sponsor my show. So knock on wood, fingers crossed, I'm hopeful that it'll happen someday. But I've also mentioned before, like, obviously that would be like a huge like thrill of a lifetime for me. But Magnus does a lot of interviews, so it would be a more gratification for me and, you know, for my longtime listeners and stuff like that. But it's not like we don't get to hear what he has to say. But anyway, it would be amazing. Magnus, holler at your boy. I'm available.
I think that would be awesome. You know, I could see one of these days you'll get there if we just keep on pushing it, you know?
Yeah. Honestly, you know what, Devon? I've never asked him. Like, there are some high-profile players who I've been like, all right, you know what? They have a course coming out or whatever, you know? Like, it's time. I'm gonna, you know, if they have a website, I'm gonna go through their website. If it's someone I know, if there's someone I know that knows them, I'm gonna reach out through that person, sort of thing. And I'll be like, it's time. But with Magnus, I've actually never technically tried. I just figure, like, you know, at some point, hopefully he'll be aware of the podcast and then he'll just sort of like reach down and choose me. But you know, maybe if I see a big project, I'll try sometime. I mean, certainly there's other high profile players that I haven't been able to get and I have tried. So,
yeah.
But anyway, Magnus, anytime.
Yeah, that would be, I think that would be really awesome. Yeah. Shoot. Man, it's just amazing. So how hard was it to be consistent for 5 years to do your podcast? Like, because that's a long time to be consistent doing it weekly. And I've been watching your podcast episodes like on YouTube not every single week, but I get like get the big ones. And yeah, I can see all the hard work, the effort that you put into it. So is it really hard to be like really consistent, especially in that business?
Thank you, first of all. Yeah, I mean, it was harder in the early days. It was harder when, you know, I felt like there weren't that many people listening. And let's be real, I mean, when you're not making money, that's the hardest time, because you really have to make time for it. I had young kids, you know, a lot of demands with my wife. And then you say, oh, I'm going to go do this thing, you know, that I'm not making any money doing. So once I started to have some success, I mean, I love doing it. It's my favorite thing. I always read, if the person I'm interviewing has written a book, I always read it. I love reading chess books. Like the fact that I can consider that part of my job is just like such a dream. You know, and like if it's a YouTuber digging into their content, trying to figure out why they're popular, trying to come up with questions that they haven't been asked, you know, 50 times. So I mean, there's one or two aspects of it I you know, could take or leave, but like 90% of it is just like an absolute dream job. So again, I try not to take that for granted and I try to devote everything I can to it. So again, once I felt like I had a little bit of traction, it hasn't been hard for me to be consistent. I mean, you do, Devon, have to be a little, you know, you have to be mindful about like sequencing of episodes, especially because mine's like an interview show. So I had to learn to sort of record, you know, a couple weeks in advance so that if someone bails on you or you have some technical issue, like you have time to sort of find your footing. Because I do find that people like to have something part of their routine. They like to know when something's coming. And they like to know that, like, if they decide to support you, like, I know you have a Patreon page, they like to know that, like, you're not going to, like, just disappear, you know, like, after they start to support you. So, but yeah, I mean, the more success you have, the easier it gets. It becomes sort of like a virtuous cycle. And I've been lucky that, again, knock on wood, but that's kind of been the direction in the past couple years.
Yeah, that's really good. And you know what? I've looked in your YouTube comments, and like one of the always like the main ones, I see the comment, man, this podcast is so underrated.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I have to tell you, I have a kind of a strange relationship with YouTube because, you know, like probably 95% of the people who listen on podcast apps. So, and YouTube, as you've probably seen, there's no video. I mean, I'm doing a new podcast with Chessable called How to Chess, where we do, where we often have video as well. But with Perpetual Chess, even if, like, I'm looking at you now on Zoom, you know, even though we're looking at each other online when we film, I never release the video. So I was a little surprised when people started asking me to even post it on YouTube. Because I was like, it's not the most natural. Like, the reason I got into podcasts is because I was driving all over the place and looking for a way to entertain myself and doing a lot of chores around the house, doing the dishes, cooking dinner, whatever. And it's a great companion for stuff like that. YouTube to me is something that requires more engagement more often than not. So because of all that, and because YouTube, I have to do a bit of extra work because I have to make the sort of video rendering, and I can't do that until the podcast is already out. So it's always the last place to get it. And something about YouTube commenters, they've mostly been nice to me, but still, like, you get more snarky comments, you have to delete all the stupid porn spam chat stuff. YouTube has not been my favorite, I have to say. But I mean, obviously, anyone who listens on whatever platform, I appreciate you. So I don't want to go too far down the anti-YouTube road.
Right. And so, you know, I just want to let everybody know that, like, Perpetual Chess, the podcast, is on, and you can correct me too, but I've seen that it's on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts. Is that your main ones? Yeah,
I mean, these days I can't even keep track of all the podcast apps. You know, someone will be like, "Are you on Podbean?" And I'm like, "What's a Podbean?" You know, but I'll try to find out. And like every once in a while, you have to like jump through some new hoop to get on some new app. But basically, I think it's on like every major podcast app. Like it should be streamlined at this point. And you know, if anyone listening looks on somewhere and it's not there, like I do want to know, and I will get it on there. So, you know, don't want people to have to jump through hoops to consume your content, you know?
Right, right. And then each platform is basically a whole set of new people that I've noticed this past year. So yeah, I definitely understand that.
Yeah. And I know you've got a lot of balls in the fire. You know, you're doing Twitch, YouTube, and the podcast as like basically separate things, right?
Yeah. I'm going to lean more into the podcast. So podcast is always first. That's always going to be first in my book, since this is my baby and it took off a little bit quickly, more quickly than I thought it would take off. But yeah, I got consistent viewers and it's really awesome to like help people out and stuff like that. And then more on YouTube too. But Twitch is really hard. I'm not going to lie.
Man,
it's
you're competing
really
with freaking Hikaru and Eric Rosen and these guys. Like they're so good at it. And like someone awesome's always on, you know, it's tough.
Yeah, and like I said, I have a kid. So I can't do that like 3-hour stream I don't have the time. It's when it comes to the podcast and YouTube, that's gonna be like my main focus nowadays more than ever. Yeah. But man, thanks for being the guest. Thanks for being on here. How did you like the podcast? How did you like this episode? Yeah,
good stuff, man. Yeah, it was fun. My pleasure.
Yeah. And is there like anything else you would like to talk about or advertise, your next projects, things of that nature?
Not really. I'm trying to find the energy to write a book, but it's so far I have 0 words written, so not much to say about that. I mean, listeners, if you're interested in checking out my work, I basically just do podcasts and that's it. The Perpetual Chess Podcast is kind of like the flagship. And as we discussed, interviewed Vishy Anand and Gotham Chess a couple times and Naroditsky, and check out the Adult Improver interviews if you're out there grinding, trying to improve at chess. Check it out, subscribe. Actually, subscribe even if you don't check it out. That's a very important tip. And I also have a new project with Chessable called How to Chess, which is the idea is it's only it's a 10 to 15 minutes per week, and it's about a specific chess improvement topic. So Perpetual Chess, I know it's a big time investment. We're talking often over an hour per week. And I know some people have short commutes and some people might be more interested in working on their own games than about like hearing Grandmaster tales and stuff like that. So it's kind of like different approach, but I still have good guests sharing good tips. So yeah, check those out and support Davon, man. It's good. I know that you got a lot going on in your life, man. I know, you know, you got a young daughter, you're working a lot and grinding hard on this content on the side. So I definitely wish you luck and commend you for putting it out there, Davon.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you a lot. And, you know, all the people that is listening, go follow Chess Perpetual. He's on Instagram, Twitter,
got a website and everything. Tips, man. Because I'm very active on Twitter and I build a decent following there. And on Instagram, I just feel like I'm like in a foreign country. I don't know what I'm supposed to do.
Yeah,
I mean, I do post the clips and stuff, but like, you got to give me some hacks before we get out of here. What am I supposed to do there, man?
Yeah, Instagram is kind of hard. We're in this new space now where Reels are taking off. Just short videos, and you know Instagram is going, it's rumored, I'm not going to confirm this, but it's rumored that it's going more video. Like they're going to get away from the post, so it's going to go more visual, more video. It's probably going to be like another TikTok platform or YouTube platform. So my videos on Instagram has got I was posting pretty much every single day, and I had a steady following each and every day, and then people from the podcast like followed and things of that nature, and that's cool. Thank you for all the people that like DM'd me and liked the podcast too, and liked the jokes. I really appreciate that. And so, yeah, Instagram is just a whole nother beast. It's a whole nother platform.
Reels, you're saying? Because I mostly just post pictures. Clips. I post clips from the podcast, but I don't do any stories really. I guess I got to get on that.
Yeah. It's more visual, more reels, and more videos. That's all I can say about it, pretty much.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know if I have it in me, man. I'm an old man, but I'll try. I'll try to keep up with you, young bucks.
Yeah. And you know what? I'll say that for later. But anyway, thank you for joining the Chess Knowledge with H1 podcast. I really appreciate it. And hopefully y'all enjoyed this. If you did enjoy it on the Apple podcast, please leave a good review, because this is going to be on the season 5 of Chess Knowledge with H1 podcast. And you know what? I bring every week chess knowledge, chess wisdom, chess understanding, always. So thank you for all the supporters. Thank you for everybody who has been with me since the beginning, and the people who are joining right now. And peace out. And
all right, good night, everyone. Thanks.
I'll see you later. And maybe Ben, maybe another time you'll come and you're invited on the podcast whenever you want. Yeah.
I didn't flunk out. That's good news. All right. Yeah. Sounds good.
Oh, no, you definitely got to ask, Nero. I'm just playing. Okay. Peace out. Bye. Hey, you made it. Thank you for listening to the episode. And you know what? If you like the episode a lot, please follow so that you don't miss out on any new information. And if you're trying to get better at chess, please follow the YouTube channel Chess Knowledge with H1. And guess what? If you really, really like the episode or really, really like the podcast, if you're on Apple Podcasts, please leave a good review so that we can get some more exposure, because this information is for free. Thank you, and I will see you on the next episode. Peace.